On December 4, 1872, the Mary Celeste, a merchant ship, was found adrift and abandoned in the Atlantic Ocean. The last entry in the ship's log had been penned 10 days prior. The ship's cargo was untouched, its provisions aplenty. The crew's personal belongings lay intact. In fact, nothing seemed largely amiss aboard the ship, which was disheveled but still very much seaworthy. That is, apart from one leering fact. Of the 10 souls on board the ship when she set sail from New York nearly a month prior, not a single person remained. Hello, everyone. I'm your host, Megan, and welcome back to Haunted History. I hope everyone is having a great week. This week's episode is a bit special for me. So I am originally from Nova Scotia, and today's story centers around Nova Scotia and the Maritimes. So it's been very cool to kind of learn a little bit about my home province's history and to get to share that with you. As I mentioned briefly last week, our website is now live, so feel free to visit us at hauntedhistorypod.com and subscribe to our mailing list if you want to be included in our monthly newsletter. There are some really great short stories, specifically haunted historical places and ghost stories, that may not be juicy enough for a full episode. So in our newsletter, we are going to share some of those places with you. All right, well, that is enough babbling for me. Let's get to today's story. The sea, the subject of poems, odes, and songs. Sometimes the provider of bountiful catches. At others, she makes widows out of women. The sea has always fascinated folks, from settlements erected on its coasts to the gods and goddesses that populated its depths. The sea is a source of inspiration, curiosity, deference, and death. Our story begins on Spencer's Island, which was in actuality the name of a small town in Nova Scotia. Surrounded on all fronts by the tempestuous Atlantic Ocean, Nova Scotia is home to many coastal rural communities. Spencer's Island, surrounded by the Bay of Fundy, is no exception. However, this small community became a significant cog in the Great Age of Sail in the later part of the 1800s. Nova Scotia would go on to have a lot of importance in seafaring during the 19th century. As for Spencer's Island Shipbuilding Company, it laid down the woodwork for the keel, the bottommost part of a ship, for its first ship in 1860. By 1861, the Spencer Island Shipbuilding Company's first ship was built in full. The shipyard where the works took place belonged to a local man named Joshua Dewis, using locally sourced timber. It was a two-masted affair called a brigantine. On May 18, 1861, the ship was christened the Amazon, and shortly later, she was officially registered in the town of Parsborough. The Amazon was a sturdy build and poised to be a dependable and versatile trade ship, emblematic of Nova Scotia's growing maritime presence. The ship was owned by a group of local businessmen, including Joshua Dewis, as well as brothers Jacob and Isaac Spicer. A man named Robert McClellan was also a part of the shareholders group, and he had the honor of serving as captain on the Amazon's maiden voyage. These men, it should be mentioned, were more like a coalition of farmers, fishermen, and builders, all with a flair or desire for trade and commerce. In June of 1861, the Amazon was tasked with taking a cargo of timber overseas from nearby Five Islands. She was to sail across the fabled Atlantic, and to London, to be precise. So back then, Nova Scotia had yet to join the collection of provinces that would be eventually known as Canada, and so because of this, she would sail under the British flag. While the crew painstakingly loaded the ship, Captain McClellan nursed what he perceived to be a pesky cold. As the Amazon sailed off, He reckoned that the briny mist rising from the Bay of Fundy would be the perfect antidote to what ailed him. As the Amazon barely passed a nearby island of New Brunswick, which is another Canadian province, McClellan began showing signs of pneumonia. The crew rightfully decided that their captain could not survive the nearly 3,000-mile trip across the ocean, so they turned back. In the day that it took for the Amazon to circle back to Spencer's Island, McClellan declined rapidly. Once ashore, he was quickly taken to the home of Jacob Spicer. After 2 days of lingering sickness, Robert McClellan died. The crew of the Amazon wrapped Robert's body in linens and placed him in a small boat. Then they made their way solemnly to the small Nova Scotian town of Economy, where Robert was from. It's said that upon seeing the boat and the Amazon's crew heading towards the coast, Robert's young wife was spotted running down to the shore, a pained and shocked expression painted upon her face. The maiden voyage of the Amazon was tainted, but it would still be a while before one would whisper, "Cursed." For a few years, the Amazon sailed in a series of uneventful voyages. Then, in 1867, grumblings between the owners about their dissatisfaction with the ship's current captain began to bubble and froth up. And so, the captain, a man named William Thompson, was set to be replaced at a rendezvous point in Halifax, Nova Scotia. However, before the transfer could take place, Captain Thompson, suspiciously, ran the Amazon ashore just off Cow Bay in Cape Breton on November 1st of that year. Interestingly, the ship's insurance didn't cover any wreckage after November 1st in that region. Additionally, the shareholders couldn't raise enough funds to repair or claim their ship. Sadly, she was surrendered to whoever could salvage her. It is heartbreaking to think of the group of farmers, fishermen, and builders who had pooled all of their resources together to build this commercial endeavor, and then to lose her to circumstances beyond their control. This, sadly, was their misfortune. Much talk is made of William Thompson's intentions. It stands to be believed that perhaps he had sold out the ship's owners. Shortly after she was run ashore, the Amazon fell very swiftly into other hands. The Amazon's original register was quickly canceled, and a new man, dubbed Alexander McBean Gentleman, registered the ship under his name. Interestingly, it was sold to another man, John Howard Beatty Gentleman, within the week. This fact is most suspicious, as per maritime law at the time, a vessel could not be sold to a new ownership unless it was fit for sea. So if the Amazon had truly been run ashore and wrecked, it wasn't likely that it would be fit for sea merely a week later. The Amazon's voyages under the ownership of John Beatty, gentlemen, are largely unknown. It was reported that the ship was again run ashore at least two times, once in Cape Breton and once in Maine. This begs the question, was it sheer misfortune or a calculated risk for some sort of insurance scam? Details are vague. Suffice to say, by November of 1868, the Amazon reappeared onto the scene as a completely wrecked vessel up for grabs at a public auction in New York. And so begins her second chapter. In November 1868, at a public auction house in New York, a gentleman named Richard W. Haynes walked away with $1,750 less in his pocket and a whole ship. What he didn't pay for her up front, he made up for in repair costs. After a new keel, stern, and bottom were in place for the sum of $8,825, she was once again sea-ready. As she was acquired in the United States, Haynes insisted that she bear the American flag. With that, he hurried to the registry. There, he reasoned that her name should be changed. Why he chose the name Mary Celeste is lost to time. Celeste is a name that beckons the heavens, good and light, think like celestial. Yet, The Mary Celeste has always refused to belong to anybody. And much like a wild horse tries to buck off a cowboy, or a sneaker wave traps an unsuspecting swimmer in the crags, this ship has always betrayed her masters. She is tinged with malice. Of the many seafaring superstitions, the belief that changing the name of a ship brings about bad luck is perhaps one of the most widely accepted and believed among mariners. It's said that naming a ship beholds it to a so-called ledger of the deep, and to change its name without any proper rituals would mean angering or trying to cheat the gods, such as Poseidon or Neptune, or maybe even Davy Jones of pirate lore. Rituals of renaming center around purging the ship of any previous ledgers or markings with the ship's old namesake and ushering in the new name with bells and libations, while promising to honor the sea gods. No records stand as to what Haines did when he changed the Amazon's name to the Mary Celeste. If history is any indication, one could say that the sea gods were not too pleased. As her captain, Haines was unlucky. Within 10 months, he had to part with her due to mounting debt. Captain James H. Winchester would be her new owner. A retired seafarer himself, Winchester had turned his retirement from sailing into a brokerage business. In 1872, Winchester found himself in the crosshairs of the law. A long trail of shady dealings traced behind the Mary Celeste's path of ownership, and Winchester would bear the brunt of it. After many months of litigation and investigation, the captain was finally cleared of any wrongdoing. That same year, significant changes were made to the ship. A new frame was put in, and an extra deck was added. The ship was now bigger and reinforced. In order to recuperate his expenditures, Winchester endeavored to sell one-third of the shares in the ship. With this, a new owner, proverbially and literally, came aboard. This man was named Benjamin S. Briggs. Benjamin Spooner Briggs was a sailor, like his father and his grandfather before him, but he was also a man of God, first and foremost. Briggs was a devout Christian and no stranger to losing himself in readings of the Bible and taking part in prayer groups. In 1855, he had sailed as a part of a small crew under his father, Captain Nathan Briggs. In a few short years, he rose through the ranks as a master himself, having commanded several voyages in his own right. Briggs was an expert seafarer, a so-called master mariner, which was the highest grade of seafaring qualifications. At the time, Benjamin Briggs had, in fact, spent the better part of his life at sea. In November of 1872, Briggs was put in place as the master of a new ship, the Mary Celeste, in which he now had stakes. The young captain was diligent when assembling his crew, so for his first mate, he chose a man by the name of Albert Richardson. Richardson was the husband of one of James Winchester's nieces, and a trusted and capable seafarer. Andrew Gilling would be Briggs' second mate. The native New Yorker was just 25 years old. For the role of steward, the captain selected an Edward William Head, and the four remaining seamen were four Germans from the Frisian Island. I'm probably going to pronounce this incorrectly, but I'm going to try my best. Brothers Volkert and Boz Lorenzen, Arian Martens, and Gottlieb Gutschkau. That may not have been too bad. In letters detailing his preparation for the expedition on board the Mary Celeste, Briggs would write about his confidence in the crew, highlighting their very peaceful disposition. As he supervised the loading of his ship, Briggs' wife, Sarah, and their 2-year-old daughter, Sophia, came to join him. It was decided that they would be sailing with him across the Atlantic. The little family had left behind their 7-year-old, Arthur, in the care of his grandmother back home at Rose Cottage in Marion, Massachusetts. At the time, Arthur was in school, and Briggs didn't think it was necessary to pull him out of his studies. One of the more popular maritime superstitions says that the presence of a woman on board a ship is a bringer of bad luck. Women, it was said, were distractions for the sailors and would cause them to veer off course. Their agitation would anger the sea, and she would reply in kind, sending waves of water as a mirror of their fluctuating and sometimes impulsive emotions. Perhaps it was Benjamin Briggs' God-fearing nature that allowed him to brush off these superstitions so easily. Or maybe it was just a sign of the times. As the great age of sail had ended, some superstitions were being cast overboard. Historically speaking, it wasn't uncommon for captains to have their family, pets included, join them on overseas travel. In a letter written by Sarah Briggs, she details how little Sophia found herself enamored with the ship's cat, and she noted her satisfaction with her living quarters, as well as the quiet capability of the crew. On paper, the Mary Celeste was seaworthy in the eyes of Captain Briggs, and he was surrounded by what he himself deemed first-class sailors. While Briggs and his crew prepared their ship for departure, another similar ship was stationed in nearby Hoboken, New Jersey, gearing itself up for a similar voyage. The Nova Scotian brig, De Gratia, was manned by Captain David Reed Morehouse and his first mate, Oliver DeVoe, and was set to sail towards Genoa by way of Gibraltar a week after the Mary Celeste. According to recollections of Captain Morehouse's widow, it's said that Benjamin Briggs and David Morehouse shared a meal on the eve of the Mary Celeste's departure, where they talked about their shared interests and future plans. What they discussed, though, has been lost to history, I'm afraid. The Mary Celeste, for its part, was destined for Genoa and carried a huge shipment of denaturalized alcohol. Interestingly, part of Captain Briggs' religious devotion meant he believed in practicing abstinence and teetotaling, or the lack of alcohol consumption. All in all, only 10 souls would be on board the small brig for this sailing. As the ship was towed out of port, it suddenly stopped just off Staten Island. Echoing the staggered departure of her maiden voyage, Captain Briggs' wife penned one last letter. In it, she said that the horrid weather had pushed back their departure, and that they were waiting for the weather to settle before moving on. This correspondence would be the last that anyone would ever hear from those on board the Mary Celeste. And the staggered departure, in hindsight, was an ill omen of things to come. A mere 8 days after the Mary Celeste finally dislodged itself from the coast of Staten Island and sailed towards Genoa, the De Gratia was beginning its trade voyage along the same route. The De Gratia left port in New York and was bound for Gibraltar. She was a bigger brig than Mary Celeste, but not by much, and her crew amounted to 10 souls as well. As they sailed eastward, a steady stream of inclement weather barreled down upon them. They churned on towards Azores, an archipelago in the Atlantic Ocean. On December 4th, Captain Morehouse was called by his troubled crew. There, in the distance, a ship was sailing directly toward them and moving erratically. At the time, the crew of the De Gratia had taken their ship safely past the Azores and were about midway between the island chain and coast of Portugal. This route, as we said earlier, was the same route that was to be taken by the Mary Celeste shortly over a week earlier. Captain Morehouse raised a spyglass to his face. The crew were right. There, on the horizon, a vessel not unlike theirs was headed straight toward them. Her movements were scattered, and her sails fluttered chaotically in the wind. He beckoned one of his ship's most trusted men. Shortly after, First Mate Oliver DeVoe emerged from below deck. Captain Morehouse wordlessly handed him the spyglass. DeVoe took one look and confirmed aloud that a ship was in their wake, a mere 4 or 5 miles away, and headed straight for them. They decided to press on and inched closer to the vessel, reasoning that perhaps her crew needed assistance. As they neared the ship, a sense of eeriness took over the crew of the De Gratia. They noted the disheveled but otherwise seaworthy condition of the vessel before them. This, however, was not the source of their wariness. As the crew hailed for any person on board the vessel, they were only met with the creakiness of sea-weary wood and the sounds of sails flustering in the wind. Oliver DeVoe, along with two other crewmen, including Second Mate John Wright, lowered a boat from the De Gratia and paddled toward the strange ship. The waters were still agitated, remnants of the tempestuous weather that they had experienced throughout the last week, no doubt. As they inched closer, DeVoe thought to himself that the ship's crew must be below deck, as maybe they had fallen ill. Armed with this thought, he set foot on the ship. As he stepped on board, DeVoe called out. No one answered, and a quick tour of the ship revealed that no one was on board. He walked toward the ship's stern and ran his fingers across the markings etched upon it. There, as Captain Morehouse had previously suspected, the words Mary Celeste stared back at him. He set foot into the captain's quarters where all personal belongings had been left untouched. The ship's logbook indicated that the last entry had been made at 5 a.m. on November 25th. Citing that the ship had safely made it along the coast of Santa Maria in the Azores. Around 3 feet of water had been sloshing around the ship. It wasn't a catastrophic amount, but it did leave some indication as to how long the vessel had been left unattended. What's more, the ship's pump was found disassembled on deck. DeVoe and his crewmates continued their exploration of the ship. The skylight of the captain's cabin had been left open. The binnacle which housed the ship's compass had been shattered to bits, and the compass itself was gone. DeVoe kneeled and found a sheathed ceremonial sword underneath the captain's bed. The ship's rigging was in a bad way. One of the ship's many sails had come undone, and another was lost entirely. As DeVoe and his crewmates continued to canvass the ship, more questions than answers seemed to materialize. They noticed that the ship's hatch had been uncovered. Before long, it became apparent that the ship's entire cargo had also been left behind. Below the hatch, DeVoe gawked as 1,700 barrels of alcohol lay before him, untouched and unscathed. DeVoe was quick to note the absence of any boat affixed to the ship. On deck, a ramp had been pulled up, indicating that a gangway had been put in place to launch a boat out to sea. The rope that would have kept the boat tethered to the ship had been cut. It stood to reason that the crew had abandoned the Mary Celeste in a hasty manner. She was, by all intents, the site of a mystery and a veritable ghost ship. Back on the De Gratia, Captain Morehouse and his first mate discussed the possibility of hauling the Mary Celeste back to port as a salver. As per maritime law at the time, when an abandoned ship was brought back to port, the monetary value of its cargo and the ship itself was divvied up among the salvagers. In his personal letters to his wife, DeVoe recounted the dangerous nature of such a voyage. Operating on a skeleton crew of only three, with DeVoe serving as captain, one deckhand, and one cook, the mildly mangled Mary Celeste would have to travel the remaining 600 miles to the port of Gibraltar. And so she did. But, as we have come to understand, the Mary Celeste leaves none of her captains unmarked. So when, after a long and strenuous journey, the Mary Celeste finally docked a day behind the De Gratia, DeVoe once again put pen to paper.
I had two men out of the brig and brought her in here. I had a hard time of it. I would not like to undertake it again. I had very fine weather for the first 2 or 3 days, and then we had it hot and heavy. I made the land all right, and it was blowing a gale, and I got drove through the gut and 40 miles to leeward. My men were all but done out when I got in here, and I think it will be a week before I can do anything, for I never was so tired in my life. I can hardly tell what I'm made of, but I do not care as long as I got in safe.
No sooner had the Mary Celeste docked into Gibraltar than the heavy hand of the law came firmly down on it. Before Captain Morehouse and his crew could make out with any sort of profit, a trial had to be undertaken to find out exactly what had happened on board the ship. And so Frederick Flood, Attorney General appointed by the Queen, was in charge of proceedings. Flood's reputation was terrible. He was openly known as a daft man with a baseless aura of pompousness. He was also incredibly stubborn, and when an idea came about him, like a dog with a bone, he was unable to let it go. The idea that a seaworthy ship filled to the brim with precious cargo would be abandoned by its capable captain was unthinkable. He is actually quoted on record as saying, "I am wholly unable to discover any reason, whatever why, the said vessel should have been abandoned." It seemed, through the proceedings, that Flood retrofitted any evidence based on this belief alone, instead of letting the clues behind this mystery speak for themselves. Flood openly insinuated that Morehouse and his crew had engaged in an act of wanton piracy, a fact ferociously denied by the crew of the De Gratia. The mystery was less paranormal and more piracy, he believed. An act of insurance fraud with pricey alcohol as the baseline. The disappearance of the crew of the Mary Celeste, he ventured, amounted to a calculated murder. And so an examination of the Mary Celeste was ordered. A man named John Austin was tasked with this endeavor. He was also employed by the Queen. Austin walked every inch of the ship. He zeroed in on a small vial of sewing machine oil that remained standing upright. This, he reasoned, proved that inclement weather had not befallen the Mary Celeste. Of course, he failed to consider that at any point, the vial could have been absentmindedly placed upright again by any of the numerous people that had been on board the ship, including himself. The examination also made use of a diver, a man named Ricardo Portinato. Portinato examined the ship's hull and found no evidence that the ship had suffered an accident or collision. However, hack marks on the ship's bow, reported Austin, signified human interference. What's more, there appeared to be bloodstains on the sword in the captain's quarters. Flood argued at first that it was Briggs' own men that had mutinied under the drunken influence of their precious cargo. He believed that they had murdered the Briggs family in cold blood and staged the ship to make it look like an accident. Perhaps, he ventured, they had even been whipped into a frenzy by the mere fumes of the alcohol. For a while, a theory had even been floated around that the Lorenzen brothers were directly to blame, as none of their belongings had been left behind. However, once their families were contacted, it had been revealed that they, in fact, lost all of their belongings during a previous expedition shortly before boarding the Mary Celeste. And so, slowly, evidence of a mutiny was refuted. In a second examination made by the U.S. Navy, it was agreed that the markings on the bow were actually quite standard for a seafaring vessel that had accrued some seasoning over time. What's more, the apparent bloodstains had been tested chemically, revealing that they were not, in fact, blood at all. Flood's case crumbled. As James Winchester touched down in Gibraltar himself in January 1873 to assess the state of the court proceedings regarding his ship and its cargo, he is said to have gotten into a heated exchange with Flood. The grumblings around town had been that some sort of insurance scam was afoot, one that included collusion between Winchester and Captain Morehouse. The evidence of such a scam, however, was non-existent, and as such, Flood reluctantly released the Mary Celeste back to her rightful owner. James Winchester's ownership of the Mary Celeste had proved tumultuous and was anything but smooth sailing. The salvors, for their part, had received only a small fraction of money for their operation. 1,750 pounds to be exact. This sum amounted to less than 20% of the ship's total value, cargo included, and was considered a very small sum for the services rendered. Perhaps, the absence of having any grounds to convict the crew of any foul play, the courts sought to punish them otherwise. Shortly after reclaiming the Mary Celeste, Winchester parted ways with his ship. At the time, she was widely reported as being cursed. In 1879, the ship was docked at the island of St. Helena, where her captain, Edgar Tuttle, had fallen ill. He died shortly after. Indeed, the Mary Celeste went through many owners until 1885, when she was deliberately grounded by her current owner, a man named Gilman C. Parker, off the island of Haiti. Parker and his co-conspirators had over-insured the ship and loaded her with worthless cargo, including, it's been said, cat food. However, the Mary Celeste had other plans and amazingly refused to sink. As so, the ruse had been discovered, and the men responsible were arrested. So at the time, this type of crime carried the punishment of death. Parker was spared such a fate, but misfortune caught up to him nonetheless. A mere 3 months after being released from jail, he died. As for his co-conspirators, one of them was committed to a psychiatric hospital, and the other took his own life. A year after the crew of the Mary Celeste vanished, young Arthur Briggs received some packages in the mail. The packages bore the seal of the U.S. consul at Gibraltar. As he unwrapped one of the packages, he found himself holding his father's ceremonial sword. The last remnants of the Briggs family had made its way onto land. What happened to the crew of the Mary Celeste is truly one of the most enduring naval mysteries to this day. Any evidence that Briggs willingly disappeared as a part of some sort of insurance scam with his co-conspirators, such as Morehouse, seems to fall apart as his son, Arthur, was left behind. This fact alone supports the idea that the Briggs always intended to return home and is further advanced by their numerous correspondences with their family and friends during the voyage. Another small yet important point to consider is the cat. Since little Sophia had taken a liking to the cat, and it was nowhere to be found when the ship was boarded by the crew of the De Gratia, it stands to reason that all who were alive, beast and man, were taken on a lifeboat. If the boat had been mutinied, surely the cat would have been spared, one would like to think. The idea that the ship could have been overtaken by pirates was also floated around, naturally. However, the fact that no valuables, including the cargo, had been stolen refutes this entirely. One of the more popular and widely held beliefs is that with 1,700 barrels of alcohol having been loaded and packed up in New York, and then sailing down to the warm Azores, perhaps the conditions below the hatch warranted some sort of pressure change, resulting in a gas leak. And maybe the captain reasoned that in order to keep his family and crew safe, they should board the lifeboat and stay away from the main ship until the danger had passed. In this position, something unfortunate could have happened, like an unruly sea or a broken tether, resulting in the boat being cast adrift and the whole crew perishing. Benjamin Briggs' own cousin, Oliver Cobb, was an active supporter of this theory that something dangerous had occurred on the ship, and that his cousin reasoned that the lifeboat was the crew's only chance at safety, a mistake that ultimately cost everyone their lives. The ship's logbooks indicate that on the 25th of November, the island of Santa Maria was within view of the ship. So typically, if one were to abandon ship, it would be most favorable to do so when close to land. The only element that directly refutes the claim of an explosion is the fact that no markings or any type of fire or accident seem to be present on the ship. What's more, it's still believed that even in the event of a fire on board, Briggs would have known that the chances of survival were much higher on board the ship than in the lifeboat. One thing is certain, the use of the lifeboat had been based in panic, as the rope tethered to it had been cut, as opposed to untied, and all of the belongings had been left behind. Alongside man-made beliefs about what caused the crew of the Mary Celeste to abandon ship are the plethora of natural phenomena that could possibly be involved. As we said from the top, the ocean is laden with mysteries and begs a respectful fear. The presence of water in the ship has been a fascinating clue for many historians and amateur sleuths alike. The presence of a sounding rod on board the ship indicated that there was the possibility that perhaps the crew thought that the Mary Celeste was taking on much more water than what was actually true, and had reasoned that abandoning the ship was all that was left to do in light of such a certain fate. Perhaps a waterspout, a type of water tornado, had rained down on the ship, and the pumps had malfunctioned, which accounts for why they had been disassembled on deck. In 2006, a chemist named Andrea Sella from the University College in London undertook an experiment for the television show Channel 5. A scale model of the Mary Celeste's hold was built, and butane gas was released in order to imitate a pressure wave explosion. Interestingly, although the explosion was loud and the initial ball of flame was big, no scorch marks were left behind. The explosion, he said, could have been powerful enough to dislodge the hatch cover, which was how it was found. Alternatively, perhaps the hatch cover was manually opened for the crew to peer inside. Log entries do support the idea that sounds could be heard under the hatch, although this wasn't uncommon. According to records, it was demonstrated that over 300 gallons of alcohol had leaked during the voyage. This is because 9 of the barrels were empty. However, it was later noted that 9 empty barrels were made of red oak, whereas the other barrels were made of white oak. Red oak, it said, is much more porous than white oak. So could the highly volatile cargo have been the source of the crew's demise? Some say yes. Others, however, are a little bit more colorful in their takes. Indeed, the presence of sea monsters has always colored the imagination of many maritimers. Some thought that maybe a legendary kraken had enveloped the ship with its giant tentacles, and the fear-stricken crew abandoned ship before becoming the fantastic beast's lunch. Although far-fetched, the idea of a kraken itself is not too far from reality. Giant squids that inhabit the depths of the ocean do, in fact, exist. Large males can reach up to 13 meters in length, and they're known to prey upon sperm whales. In light of this knowledge, could it be unreasonable to think that a squid would latch upon a brig? Popularized by Jules Verne's novel, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, the idea that giant squid could intentionally attack vessels is actually rooted in pretty widespread mythologies from around the world. The Scandinavian kraken, as mentioned earlier, is said to be a giant cephalopod that destroys entire ships and drags sailors to their watery graves. There are, in fact, documented cases of giant squids latching onto boats. In 2003, French sailors were overcome by a giant squid that latched onto the hull of their boat as they sailed from Brittany. The mystery of the Mary Celeste is enduring, but it was cemented into the public conscience by one famous writer in particular. Arthur Conan Doyle, of the Sherlock Holmes fame, was a ship doctor before becoming a celebrated writer. In January 1884, an issue of Cornhill magazine published one of his short stories, which was a retelling, or reimagining, of what happened on the Mary Celeste, which strayed incredibly far from the truth. Unfortunately, Doyle recounted a tale of onboard mutiny, spearheaded by a disgruntled slave named Septimus Goring. Fueled by his hatred of the white race, Goring is said to have murdered the whole crew and sailed the ship to the western coast of Africa. Inherently racist, this story, of course, had no legs. Yet, at the time, it was a runaway success. So much so, in fact, that the U.S. consul in Gibraltar briefly investigated this fictional theory, and Doyle's spelling of the ship, Marie Celeste, remained in the literature of the time for years to come. The mystery of the Marie Celeste has never been solved, although endless theories have been floated around to explain the circumstance surrounding the inception of the ghost ship. Since Captain McClellan lost his life during her short-lived maiden voyage, it appears that she has carried misfortune with her in every port, and brought each new master calamity in some form or another. A hunger for capital seemed to be the ultimate curse that befell the succession of men who fell in her wake. From the ill-concocted insurance scams to running her aground, the men at her charge ran themselves ragged, trying to chase their fortunes. The Marie Celeste famously refused to sink during her last voyage, and so she was left on a reef just off the coast of Haiti, where she slowly sank into ruin, only to become part of the sea herself. Perhaps some of the more alluring, albeit creepy, aspects of the tale of Marie Celeste lie in the fact that it appears that many maritime conventions were broken, and the respect normally offered to the sea was skirted. From the casual renaming of the ship to the presence of women on board, maybe it wasn't the actual disregard of these superstitions that contributed to her endless misfortunes, but the larger theme of not being respectful to the sea, and maybe even to nature itself. I can't help but think about the massive trees that were cut down and reduced to timber that served as the Marie Celeste's first trade voyage. The whole thing is highly emblematic. The Industrial Revolution had begun. Trees were now seen as resources, a mere conduit to capital. As for the Marie Celeste, one cannot forget her original name. Amazon, that bastion of greenery, the world's lungs, that would soon be under siege by industry. Perhaps it's the whole ethos, the clashing of the old gods and old beliefs, diametrically opposing the God-fearing Christian captain and the excess of productivity that angered something. Either way, one thing is certain. The lack of answers has bred an obsession that has proven itself unrelenting throughout history. The mystery of the Marie Celeste is just as potent as it was over 150 years ago. Well, that's it for us today. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Give us a like, give us a follow, and we will see you next time on Haunted History.